Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell.
I get people off! I look for the one guy who isn't getting off, and I make him get off.
With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick.
I am the smart! I am the smart! S-M-R-T! I mean S-M-A-R-R-T!
And Michael Carlson.
Let me go, fool!
You go!
We sorry, that was a Corey and I worked on that one together.
It's from the backdraft.
Yeah, Michael's been on the show before. Right now, what's the podcast you're on? Is it the call? Oh my God, the Cthulhu one that you do with?
We do it. It's Cultivating Cthulhu. It's a Cubs history podcast. I guess like before we get started, I don't mean to interrupt, but it feels like I rank. I mean, as far as like personal experiences go, like. The Chicago Cubs and the Police Academy films on the same level. Like when I met Andre Dawson and when I met Bobcat Goldthwait, the same emotions were going through my body at the same time. I just want to let people know that's where I'm at as far as my film perspective.
Nice.
So would you just die if you like ran into Ryan Sandberg and Steve Guttenberg having dinner together?
Welcome to Bergfest.
That'd be amazing. Visit us at IHateCritics.net, EveryonesACriticPodcast.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our handle is CriticsPod. There you can watch our trailers, read the news, read Sean's reviews, and interact with us. Overall, please like us there, friend us, whatever you do on those sites, comment, all that good stuff.
Grandpa, it's a like on Facebook.
All right, okay. But it's like now, it's not friend anymore. Doesn't matter. People are getting away from Facebook anyway. And then we're on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Alexa, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcast. Please subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. We will read your reviews on the air. We haven't had one for a while, and it does help us move up the chart. So if anybody wants to give us one, we'll happily read it on the air. And then Patreon, IHateCritics.net/Patreon. It's the best way to help support the podcast. Get yourself a credit on the show. We read those at the end of every episode. And there's random merch that goes out. And you get bonus podcasts like twice a year. It's supposed to be once a month, but whatever.
We've moved Josh entirely to bonus podcasts. I don't know. That's why you haven't heard him.
That said, the bonus podcast, the last one with Josh, is out. So if you haven't heard it yet, go check that out. If you want to be a Patreon supporter, that's the best way to hear it. If you are a Patreon supporter and you can't get it to play, let me know and I can send you the feed. I guess we can start the show. The idea going forward, I think, is to try to have a third rotating guest if we can't get a permanent. And if we do get a permanent, have a fourth rotating guest so that we always have three people here. So we're going to start with Michael. He's been on before. Hopefully he comes back and enjoys us and we'll come back for more. Indiana Jones, Last Crusade turns 30. So that's what appealed to him, I'm assuming. Is that right, Michael?
Yes, I would say I'm a fan of Indiana Jones.
Cool. All right.
Sorry.
It's my fault. I'm not good at leading shows, so.
Yeah. Thanks for inviting me because it's like it feels like this is the sub like the previous to Cultivate Cthulhu, I did the Awesome Age podcast for 9 years, and just a podcast. If you're starting your own podcast out there, don't start your own Abe Vigoda death clock countdown on your podcast because it felt like that was the death knell to our personal podcast. He was Fish. And Barney Miller, and he was Tessio and The Godfather. We love Abe Vigoda, but we started doing our own Abe Vigoda death clock countdown. I think that was our death knell for the Awesome 80s podcast. But as far as the decade of the 80s, like they went out with a bang. Like there's you get Ghostbusters, you get Batman 89, you've got Uncle Buck. Like the summer of 89 was owned by, you know, we've got Batman. We've got Ghostbusters and we've got Last Crusade. I mean, two of them are sequels, but the summer was owned by those three films. But and more in particular, Batman. But it's just like, for me, like Batman and Indiana Jones and Ghostbusters, it was just the best summer of my life. It was probably like the best summer for me because my parents were like, go run around. Don't come back for a while. Like it was like I was like 10 or 11. Your parents are just like, they're old enough to just go light fires in somebody else's yard for a while.
You know, it's interesting, though, what you put out there, Michael, is that how telling 1989 is about 2019 in the way that franchises were beginning that takeover of not just the summer, but now the entire year. And 89 really is the kind of the precursor to all of that.
Yeah, Lethal Weapon 2 as well, yeah. This is the first year I got to go see movies in the theater, 89, so... I'm not sure what I saw first, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids or Batman, because I came out the same weekend, but I saw one of them first. But yeah, let's go ahead and start the show. We'll start with trailers, and we'll start with a movie from the 80s, being what installment is this? Terminator Dark Fate.
Oh, good God, I have no idea.
Is this 5 or 6?
I can't even tell. Like, what timeline is this?
I believe it's supposed to come after Terminator 2, if I'm not mistaken.
I mean, are they not all in continuity, or they are all in... I have no idea. This is so dumb, and I hated this trailer. I really did. I don't understand where we're supposed to be. I don't understand why Tully is she a Terminator? Is she not a Terminator? Mackenzie, Dave, I'm just making fun, because we love Tully. But is she a Terminator, not a Terminator? I don't know. And then there's a little kid, and she's Arnold Schwarzenegger in this version. Who cares? I'm done
is
with
Edward
the Terminator
Furlong
franchise.
In this, we know if Edward Furlong is in this.
Is he still alive?
The actor? I believe he is.
We started an Edward Furlong death count. No, I'm kidding.
did a quick story. I went to the Indianapolis Horror Hound, and I had my Philip Horror Hound experience, and I just went to go sit at the bar to watch the Bears try not to lose against the... I think they were playing the Colts at the time, and Edward Furlong comes and sits next to me, and we're just like having a beer, sitting there talking, just shooting the shit, and then girls come over, get their picture with him, and he starts talking to me about beers, and he's like, "I'll take a beer, but I won't take a mixed drink because you know roofies, man." I don't know. And I'm like, "Oh God, what does he mean? What does he mean? I know. What is he even talking about?"
Wow.
But well, so he's been in Hollywood. He was in Hollywood as a child. I think he knows what he's talking about.
Oh, man. Wow.
So he was like the king of the bar, and like people were coming there like bringing him drinks and stuff. And I'm like, I just want to watch the Bears lose like a normal Bears fan. And he comes, and it's just like just joking with me back and forth about his life experience with drug drinks.
And it's not even a podcast interview. You don't even have a recorder with you.
You're kind of annoyed because you're trying to watch the game. Oh, man. I didn't like the trailer either. And I know Josh hated it. He's been on our Facebook group saying horrible
Michael,
comments.
Did you watch the trailer?
No, I didn't. Sorry, I watched the one trailer that did matter, but it wasn't on the list. But continue.
The Nightingale, the lady who did the Babadook.
Oh, I forgot
movie.
To watch that one, yeah. But I'll look forward to anything that she's done. I've been waiting to see what she was going to do next, because the Babadook is an incredible movie.
Yeah, I mean, the trailer looks somewhat, just right of conventional, like a normal horror movie, so it was kind of shocked that it didn't have that artsy Babadook look to it. But at the same time, that could be the part of the trick, and then all of a sudden they swerve you with this awesome horror film. The Art of Self-Defense.
I've seen that trailer. That trailer is awesome. I can't wait for this movie. Jesse Eisenberg is in this one, and it's got this weird tone to it. It's so odd looking, and everything about it is so unique. I can't wait.
Yeah, I'd compare it to like Observe and Report only because I'm lazy and I can't think of it. It is that unique of a. It's hard to compare it to something
right.
else. It's just got this kind of a dark comedy look to it that I can't wait to see when it finally comes out. And then there's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Incredible, as expected. And, you know, Tarantino's killing it. He got a 7-minute standing ovation at Cannes for the debut of the movie. And. While there are some people who are talking about the inclusion of Sharon Tate and whether or not it was tasteful to include her in this particular story, I think wait to see the movie before you make any kind of judgment like that.
Right. What was the trailer we forgot, Michael?
There's a cam video out right now on YouTube for the Rambo 5 trailer. I don't know if you guys have seen that.
I have not.
No, I didn't even know that existed. Tell us about it.
It's like a totally bootleg dude just sitting. I'm like, I normally don't watch stuff like that, but I'm like, ooh, I'll click on this, Rambo 5. And then I guess he's fighting the cartels now. Like, Rambo 1, he's fighting apathy. You know, Rambo 2, he's fighting the POW MIA situation. Rambo 3, just full on Russians. Rambo 4, what was it for? Was he in Laos or Cambodia? What was he doing in Rambo 4?
I don't remember. Blowing
just,
shit up.
Just blowing up everything in the most violent way.
And this
imaginable.
One feels like the Mexican cartel. Like, that's the big bad.
Wow.
Those 70-year-old action
so what,
heroes.
So, where was this recorded from?
I don't know. I trust there's sources on the internet you're not supposed to talk about. And it's an understood agreement. I don't know. It was just like a YouTube video. Like, it popped up on my feed. Hey, you like 80s stuff? You're going to love Rambo 5. And I clicked on it. And I'm like, all right, I'll watch the first 5 seconds just to make sure it's like a real thing. And I was like, yeah, somebody recorded the Rambo 5 trailer from a theater seat.
I do believe he's supposed to be fighting the cartels. I have heard that. So
yeah.
He said that someone made it, but that's pretty cool. I can't wait.
It looks at least well made. Like some it looks at least like good cinematography, good, you know, good lighting, good framing. I can't say that for other Sylvester Stallone films.
Is he directing this one, or is a real director directing this?
Well, maybe it's just like a Kevin Costner situation where he just kind of shows up on set and he assumes he's directing.
I hope it's not like a Pig Cadillac situation where you got to, like, Clint Eastwood gets his stuntman to direct a movie.
Oh, is that who directed it?
We'll get there, yeah.
I guess, I mean, that might goes back to the Quentin Tarantino movie. It's like, I mean, you think that's because it's supposed to be like a buddy movie initially, and then all this stuff happens in 69, like between Ben Affleck and Brad Pitt, and like they're just like these best friends that are stuntmen and regular guy.
Yeah,
you know, maybe they're drawing from other like best friends and stuntmen situations.
Speaking of stuntmen, is Kurt Russell reprising his role of stuntman Mike, or is he playing stuntman Bob?
That's a good one.
I'm not kidding. I think he might be.
I would think he would try and bring because that character was a serial killer. I don't think you want to bring that character into that.
But he had his older brother, stuntman Bob, that he could be playing.
Yeah.
And he was talking to the stuntman, Brad Pitt in it. So. either way, I'm looking forward to that one. Let's get to our main movies this week, and we'll start with Aladdin.
Aladdin, yes.
Cleaned up at the box office.
It's a whole new world.
$90 million.
Or exactly the same world, just recreated with live action people, sort of, kind of.
Just like Beauty and the Beast.
Aladdin is it's basically the same movie as you saw in the in 92, was it?
Sure.
I think so. You know, Guy Ritchie is directing, which is weird, just all around strange. Him doing a kid's movie.
Sometimes you just need a guaranteed hit.
Yeah.
So you can make another movie.
Odds are he probably has a house like in Vail, and that probably costs money, okay?
Well, that's appropriate because, I mean, really, this comes down to it. Like, I said in my review that the Disney marketing team deserves a producer credit on this because on all of these Disney live-action remakes, because that's basically what we're getting here, is just this is based on productive IP, is what this is called, you know, intellectual property. Disney does not care if you like this movie. They really don't. It does not bother them either way. We had a lot of fun making fun of the Will Smith trailer initially, because when you first saw him and everybody's kind of laughing at it, Disney did not care that you were laughing at him. They knew that people were going to buy tickets for this because they recognize it. And that's basically how, with our, you know, shorter attention spans, like, hey, I know what that is. I'll go see that. I know what that is. Like, that's how our attention span works.
It's the same for, like, Broadway, too. Like, they're just redoing old stuff. You know, just people, right? It's a guaranteed profit and everything.
Yeah, To Kill a Mockingbird is killing it on Broadway right now.
At least Aaron Sorkin decided to do a little bit something unique with it. I haven't seen it,
so
but that's what he says.
Lots of walk and talk.
Right, exactly.
But, no, I know this is the cry of the artist in the world of commerce and whatnot, but it is so mercenary that it's just kind of it just feels deadening while you're watching it. And there's nothing new to it other than they shoehorn this one brand new song into it that's from the perspective of Princess Jasmine called Speechless. And the way that it is so inartfully added to this movie.
Right.
This movie is going along and suddenly out of nowhere we have a fantasy sequence where she stops the entire world so she can sing this song that nobody else can hear, that is making this point that no one else can hear. that is basically just for herself, I guess.
And it's not a song you're going to be singing
no.
later on in life.
It's specifically just, it's like the least singable song. Like, I had all these songs stuck in my head. Arabian Nights and Prince Ali. I had all of those stuck in my head, which I would have done anyway if I'd have watched the original, because they're the right. same thing. But the Speechless song is so bland and such a, you know, like a, an American Idol, what the, you know, what the American Idol winner gets stuck with at the end of the, at the, end right. of the series. But she stops the entire movie to sing this song, and then it matters in no way whatsoever for the rest, for the what came before it or what came after it. Just
it's utter no, nonsense. It's no Let It Go.
No.
Thank God.
What other, I mean, because they did live action. They started with Cinderella, is that right?
Which was actually really great. Cinderella, because Kenneth Branagh brought something different and new to that story, and brought and made it different. And since then, they've basically just recreated the animated movie in live action form each and every time to
is
lesser.
Jungle Book that way too.
Like, Jungle Book to a lesser extent, yeah.
Because I know Lion King looks exactly like Lion King.
Yeah, Jungle Book I think was a little bit darker than the cartoon was, but not much.
But Favreau's did that, and he's doing Lion King, right?
Right.
So hopefully, I don't know. I will say I took the kids to this, and I had to leave three times because my son kept puking. But we went back because I have a podcast to do. And I think we may have missed the Jasmine song. I think we I was like, this is a good time to go puke. Let's go. I caught part of it. But I will say Will Smith's the best part of this movie.
He is. You're right.
Everybody was laughing, but he's actually – he pulls it off a little bit. It's not
– he cannot sing. He does not. He should not be singing. He's a terrible singer. And when he starts singing right at the front, I'm like, "Oh boy, this is going to be a long day."
Terrible.
I'll trade you. I'm the DJ. He's the rapper.
They do mix a
he's
little
got
rap.
The body,
well, they do.
Got
that's
the brain,
but that's the. You, sorry, go, sorry, Michael.
Oh, sorry. He's the DJ. I'm the rapper from 1987. You have no idea how powerful that album was for me.
He can rap like crazy. And
that's, yeah, I know. I don't think he's either.
That's the smart part of the Prince Ali song is that they slow it down so he can do kind of some talk singing, which is much more his thing. When he starts off with Arabian Nights, it is like, oh boy, that's kind of cringing. And then the song in the cave, you know, You've Never Had a Friend Like Me, is also just a little bit like, like filled with a lot of dad jokes, and it's like, again, getting kind of cringy a little bit. But once you get to Prince Ali, and once you get to actually the second act of Aladdin, is actually really good. When you get Will Smith in his regular guise, and you see him as somebody you can recognize as Will Smith, it actually gets pretty good. The party scene that takes place with the Bollywood dancing is actually really well done. And that whole middle section of the movie actually makes me like this a little bit, to the point where I can kind of recommend it. I mean, I have to recommend it, I guess, because I don't hate it. I hate everything around it. I hate that it exists. I hate that Disney is just shitting these things out with little concern for their quality, and they're just remaking everything just based off of the marketing department. I hate all that stuff. The actual movie itself, I can't hate. It's a likable enough movie.
Yeah, I'm with you. I like the cartoon better, obviously, but
because it's shorter.
Shorter. I mean, as much as I liked Will Smith in it, I won't go as far as to say I cringed when he sang. It was definitely as bland as it could be. But it wasn't like he was missing notes or anything. It was just kind of really bland singing. But Robin Williams obviously is the best part of the cartoon as well, so it's hard to top that.
Well, no one can trust what I say about singing that I like, because I like Russell Crowe and Les Mis, so.
I'm assuming you haven't had a chance to see Aladdin.
No, it definitely seems like a movie my mom and my kids would love to go together in. Like, it seems like it would definitely appeal to those two demographics. Like, they would get the enjoyment out of it.
Yeah, I always have to fight with my in-laws because they try to take the kids to the cartoon movies and mm-hmm. these live-action things and use them as an excuse to see them because this is the kind of crap they like. But, yeah, I beat them to it.
Yeah, Michael, you're on the right track there with thinking demographically about this movie.
Yeah.
Speaking of that demographic, Brightburn.
Yeah, a little bit different.
Well, that's Superman.
Demographic, yeah. Evil Superman, to be clear. This is the movie Brightburn is about imagining the world with an evil Superman. What if Superman weren't good, he were evil? And that's pretty much all this movie has, is an idea. There's nothing more to this. Brightburn as a kid who, you know, comes to Earth in a spaceship and crashes in the backyard of Elizabeth Banks and David Denman, and they raise him as their own. He finds out he has superpowers, and he begins to start to take over the world by killing people who are in his way. I really didn't care for this. I was really... I came out of this movie kind of miserable, and really the whole movie it just has this miserable gloom throughout. It's just not a pleasant movie to watch, and I know it's a horror movie. It's not supposed to be pleasant, but it's supposed to be entertaining somehow, and I wasn't entertained. I was just kind of... It has a lot of allusions to bigger issues. Like at one point, it makes kind of allusion to him sort of like a school shooter. Like he's talking about people will know what I'm going to do and understand why later. Like he's talking like Columbine kids like talk. Like it's weird. The movie doesn't have the weight to carry that. It also just doesn't have the weight of the idea, really, because it's just all about getting to the goriest bits, like the guy who gets his jaw knocked off, or the lady who gets a piece of glass dropped in her eye and has to pull it out. And I'll give you this, it's a cool-looking visual when she's trying to see around the blood coming out of her eye. That's a really cool visual, but other than that, that's like the only thing in the movie where I'm like, okay, that's pretty cool. The rest of it was just kind of like, I just hated every moment of it.
Well, Sean was miserable, so you know I loved it.
Did you really like it, or are you joking?
No, I really liked it. It was everything Sean says is true to an extent. All it has is a Superman idea, but because of that, it allows for all these things you've seen in slasher movies. Because essentially, this is all it is a slasher movie. All these slasher movies. Now you have an idea behind it that makes it a little. It makes it different, you know. You don't have to hide the monster till the end, and then when you finally see the monster, it's kind of like, "Well, that was kind of dumb," or it's not Freddy or Jason; it's this kid, and it makes sense. And I don't know, the stuff that you see in ghost movies that you don't like, they're able to explain it here. You know, you don't have to deal with that here. The gore is exceptional. I don't know if that's the right word, but it's definitely gory. I mean, they spend a lot of time watching her pull that glass out of her eye, and. Mm-hmm. The jaw thing I thought was pretty cool, and from a gore aspect, definitely gross. And then the lack of a happy ending. I mean, I'm if anybody knows me, I like more realistic. Because, I mean, how do you beat this kid? How do you beat Superman? And I don't know. I thought that was a pretty.
I found it strange that at no point did anybody actually sit down and try and reason with the kid about, hey, you need, you know, at some point, somebody should have said, care about other people and be kind to other people. And nobody says that. Everybody's reaction to him is either fear or defensiveness throughout the entire movie. And nobody takes the opportunity to try and reason with him. And I found that to be something that I would think a parent would try to do that. There's a much better version of this in a much more realistic movie. And I know this movie isn't aiming for any kind of realism. I understand that. This is a horror movie. It's not interested in actual real ideas. But then right. It keeps bringing up real ideas and raising real ideas about what you would do in the scenario of having, if you found out your child was evil and was headed down an evil path, what would you do about it? And there's a movie called We Need to Talk About Kevin with Tilda Swinton and John C. Reilly that is an incredible movie about a woman who sees that her son is becoming this evil person and there's nothing that she can do about it. And that film has dread, it has horror, it has sadness, and it has all of the ideas and all the performances that this movie doesn't.
Yeah, I think the difference is, too, though, that the parents here are also covering up what they did mm-hmm. by bringing an alien into this world and then not telling anybody, and now it's starting to backfire. So, I mean, I buy the lack of reasoning. It's not like if it's going to be reason, it's going to come from an outside adult, and that would kind of be the counselor lady. That would probably be, and
which is another failed performance, another failed character.
I don't know.
She's immediately afraid of a 12-year-old.
I didn't think she was really afraid ever until it was the end when she had to be afraid. they let things go because they were related. The counselor was, and I don't know.
I think that they had an idea, and that this was the idea was all that they had, and I think that demonstrates itself throughout.
And by the end, though, too, he doesn't really – he breaks a girl's hand. And but other than that, nothing really happens until everything happens at once. So there really isn't a chance that – you know, no one really even knows his kid's doing it until –
Well, right there, but when he breaks the girl's hand is when you should sit him down and go, okay, instead of being afraid of him or being defensive of him, to sit him down and actually talk to him about empathy and other people and caring about other people, and nobody bothers to try and do that.
I disagree, because they tried, and he totally said, totally lacked it when they tried to talk to him about it. Moving on, that was... You know, they do move on from that, those conversations, pretty quickly without anything happening. But overall, I mean, it, even if they had that in there, I still think you get to the same spot because he's an alien and he's essentially Superman and he's evil. But did you get a chance to see it, Michael?
Yeah, I saw it. I just, it felt like an odd name, like a little too close to Breitbart. Like, it doesn't seem like something you want to name your movie in today's day and age.
Yeah.
But to me, though, like, Superman's my favorite superhero. I guess it's just those Donner films growing up and everything. But I've also recently, I mean, within, like, the last 5 years, there's the Tom DeHaven book, It's Superman, and then there's Red Sun. There's, like, these narratives out there about Superman, and it felt like they could have gone so many other different ways. Don't get me wrong. All the kills, all the physical deformity that he caused other people was fantastic. I loved all of the gore in this movie. The end where he's just sitting there on the ambulance, I thought it was fantastic. He does get injured at one point, and it feels like there are a series of conversations that he needs to have with his parents, like his parents or just his parents by themselves. Like, they're both like in these autonomous units, and they never get down and talk together and be like, I saw my son, who's been bulletproof his entire life, cut his hand. I've seen all this stuff happen. He just ripped – he bent the girl's arm in half, which was amazing. But – cinematically, but and then they needed to have those conversations with each other, and that those just weren't there. And it also just felt like I needed a couple more goes rounds, but just with the dialogue, it was pretty. I thought the dialogue was exhausting.
Yeah, and it did. I mean, everything happens at the end too. It does take a while to get there. I got to imagine this will have a sequel. It's already profitable.
Yeah. The costume, I thought the visuals were pretty awesome. I guess it's like a, I don't know, Afghan anteater. It looked pretty cool.
I actually read that it didn't do quite as well as they were hoping. The actual outlay for the movie was not the $8 million that they'd reported. It was somewhere closer to $15 to $20 million once you add in the marketing costs. And so there's a bit of disappointment, actually, in the performance of this movie.
Oh, I mean, it's still going to be profitable, but because they're already at $8 million now and the budget was $6 and you got the $15 to $20 to probably add on top of it, but I got to imagine it's going to make its money back if it's already at $8 million. But yeah, maybe it won't be enough profit for them to do it again. There's a lot of places you could go with it, but at the same time, you could, not that it's a Sixth Sense, but the bigger you make this, the less likely it is. It's going to get worse. Is what I'm getting at.
I also got to do the Josh thing and talk about the score. And I thought the score for this movie was awful. The score kept knocking me out of the movie. I thought the movie would be more interesting if the score weren't insisting that you be terrified of this child. If they'd kept with a score that was less insistent upon you being scared. This is a much better movie, but it was one of those obtrusive scores that kept pushing you like, okay, be afraid. Okay, now we're building the tension. Be afraid. And I was like, no, I'm sorry, I'm not.
Yeah. It felt like they should have given him a friend, like a dog or a neighbor or a grandparent or an uncle, something. Like, they should have given him a friend, and then he turns against him, and like at that point he's evil. Because at the beginning of the movie he's not, and then he starts talking to the spaceship in his garage, and then he becomes evil.
Yeah, it's
I like that description.
It's definitely not we need to talk about Kevin or even a movie like Us where it's just perfect. There's definitely flaws on it, but in terms of like a blockbuster entertaining horror movie, I liked it for that. But you're right, it could have been – if it was – it had the potential to be like a super artistic, neat idea. Like, we need to talk about Kevin, and instead they went for easy. But I still found it at least entertaining enough to say I'd recommend it to certain people, like myself.
Yeah, it's definitely like a Friday night fun. Like, come over, we'll get to rental. We're gonna sit down and watch this movie. It's fun.
especially the dread.
I did not find it fun. I found it miserable. I thank heaven for our next movie.
I find misery fun.
I thought the kills were amazing, and the eyeball thing was fantastic.
Yeah, the eyeball thing, like, had me turn my head, and then I turned back, and they're still doing it, and then all of a sudden, it lingered on it so long that I was able to watch it. but, yeah, it was, and then, like you said, the visual of her looking out of the eyes was amazing. Probably the best part of the movie right there.
Yeah.
All right. Sean wants to move on to Booksmart.
I want to move on to a good movie. Booksmart is directed by Olivia Wilde, the actress who's known for Tron Legacy, among other things. And
largely the TV show House.
Largely the TV show House, yes, but she's been acting for a while now, and she's been directing for a little while. She's actually done a number of short films. She did a video for the Red Hot Chili Peppers, so this isn't the first time she's been behind a camera, but it's the first feature-length time she's been behind the camera, and she's pretty great at it for a first-timer. This movie is a lot of fun. Beanie Feldstein and Caitlin Dever are the stars here as Molly and Amy. They've spent their entire high school lives being the best at being at school in terms of their, you know, focusing on grades and trying to get into the best college. Then Molly overhears some kids making fun of her for her, you know, being so dedicated to school, and she confronts them and tries to throw the fact that she's going to Yale in their face, and finds that, oh, well, they're actually just as well achieving as her. In fact, there's a girl that she's been referring to as AAA for reasons that you'll have to see the movie because it's very funny. She's actually going to Yale as well, and then she finds out that everybody, the jock kid Nick, Cuba Gooding Jr.'s son, is going to Georgetown. Like, everybody has actually pretty well achieved at this school, and that she and Amy had been doing it wrong this whole time. They could have done both. They could have been high-achieving academics and having a good time. And so they decide to cram all that good time into one night, the night before graduation. And they're going to go to a party at Nick's aunt's house, but they have to figure out where the party is, and that's going to lead them along a number of different paths that are all very, very funny. One funnier than the next, really. And part of the reason why everything is so funny is Billie Lord. She is incredible. She plays a character named Gigi, who keeps popping up along the way in this movie. Billie Lord, by the way, Carrie Fisher's daughter. Just and absolutely has her mom. You could see her mom in a couple of scenes, which is pretty great, in her face. She is hysterical. Just constantly funny. Every time she pops up, it's a bigger laugh. And I loved that. I loved everything about this movie, but she really stood out as my favorite thing. The other thing is Jessica Williams from The Daily Show and Two Dope Queens, the podcast. She's just so funny as Amy and Molly's favorite teacher, who has her own kind of running gag going late in the movie with a student who has a crush on her. That pays off in, another great big laugh at the end. I really love this movie.
Did you see it, Michael?
Yeah, I saw it. I thought it was a lot of fun. It wasn't as good. I mean, I was a big fan of the the To-Do List. Have you seen the To-Do List?
Sounds familiar.
It's Aubrey Plaza's in it.
Oh, okay, I've seen that.
And then also like Easy A. But having said that, it was a lot of fun. I really liked it. It feels like if we need more movies like with teenage girl protagonists, because like especially like in the '80s movies, 99.9% of those movies are all about dudes, except Just One of the Guys, which is fantastic. But this movie did remind me a lot of Just One of the Guys, and maybe like Can't Buy Me Love. Just like the magnification of the groups was fantastic, like the nerds, and also just like the magical, like, I don't know if it's magical realism or not, if I'm using that term properly, but those kids, Carrie Fisher's daughter would just show up magically in all these different places. And then the kids, the theater kids, were so theater kids. And it was so much fun watching them just be theater kids. I think if this makes money, it's going to lead to more movies like this. And I love that. This is just like, it's a throwback to those 80s movies, but there's females, you know, protagonists, which is amazing.
Yeah, I'm with you. My wife actually didn't really care for the movie. She just thought it was okay at best. But I disagree with her there, but you know, I wouldn't put this on the level of like Lady Bird or, you know, or even what was the other one we liked last year with, I can't remember the name, Kumail Nanjiani, that one he wrote and directed, not that he didn't direct it, but did he? It doesn't matter.
What, The Big Sick?
The Big Sick movies. I thought those were, like, will be top of the list of the year movies. This one is more in the Superbad, which will be our classic, and I think it's more on that level of good, and I had a lot of fun with it. I do like Superbad better, but at the same time, I think this one's more important, I guess, the way they treat people in this movie. There's no real judging. They have the stereotype, then they tear the stereotype down. I don't even think they're even trying to necessarily. It just happens.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing in your face. There's no, you know, Avengers scene where all the girl female characters get together. It's everything's just organic, and it's really cool and a lot of fun. It's hilarious beginning to end.
These are the millennials that I want. You know, these I want to see. I want the millennial generation to be this group of people, like this group of people who care about each other and who are competitive with each other, but also very supportive and sweet, and you know, with the similar kind of eccentricities that we get that are so much demonized in our culture.
But that's the thing.
We need help as a group to take down these baby boomers, and if these people are on our team, it's a better world with that.
Absolutely.
With you completely. I do like the fact that, you know, in real life, when you're in high school, you have your cliques, whatever. But then when you run into each other 5 years later, 10 years later, it's different. You know, it's in your mind, you still kind of judge them the way you did in high school. But as soon as you start talking to them, it's just like, oh, you're just person two. And they capture that here, kind of, especially in the AAA scene towards the end of the movie.
Yeah.
I thought was really, really well done. And I thought it was really. I think the weakest part of the movie was, although funny, was Jason Sudeikis.
Yeah,
I just that a principal having to be an Uber driver does not work. Teacher, sure. Principal, I don't know.
Yeah,
When he turns around and he hands him like the 11 cords, it's like every other Uber or Lyft you've ever been in.
A lot of truth in that scene, but of course he is Olivia Wilde's husband. So that's kind of explains his involvement,
right? No, I think
a little bit.
If they would have made him a teacher or something like that, it would have been better for me. Because all I'm going is thinking is principals make like near six figures, if not more. So they don't have a second job.
But they could have at least given him an ex-wife that's taking part of his money or something.
Something to set my mind at ease. But otherwise, I really, 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 it's definitely the best movie of the week.
Yeah, no questions about that. I also love the way that they handle Amy's sexuality in the movie. It's very natural. They don't really call a lot of attention to it. She's got a crush on another girl, but it's perfectly natural. Like, and so often, you know, you have to, like, in most recent years, as this type of portrayal has come about, we've seen more homosexual characters in movies, the movie tends to stop dead to talk about it. This movie doesn't do that, and that's another great leap forward, I think.
Well, also, you'd have, like, the theater kids, like, in the movie, like, that'd be, oh, those are the gay kids doing gay stuff, you know, but here it's a real, like, they show it as a real person.
Yeah.
And they will, when the theater kids were first introduced, my wife taps me on the shoulder and says, there's a kid in my school that's exactly like this kid right there. It was fairly realistic, a little heightened, but still a lot of fun, and definitely go see it.
The murder mystery party was fantastic, and the use of Gigi in that scene blew my mind. I loved it so much.
The use of her in every
scene. Every
scene
blew
my mind.
It's like I love the sub-family off in the corner. Like, this is my house for now.
Honestly, like, Gigi may be my favorite character of 2019 so far.
I wouldn't blame you for that. All right, let's move on to our classic.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized Undisputed
Classic
Superbad.
Hard to believe this movie is how old is this movie now? 10 years old?
Close, if not 10 years, right near it.
I think it's 2007.
Yeah,
oh, it's way
12
past
years.
10.
That's crazy. It's that long ago, right?
Yeah.
Superbad. Michael Cera and Jonah Hill essentially playing analogs of Evan Goldberg and Seth Rogen, the creators of the movie. They're best friends in high school and about to finish high school, and they're trying to get with these particular girls are going to be at this party at Jules' house. Jules is Emma Stone, who Jonah Hill wants to be with.
For lack of a better
phrase. And to get there, they need to get they need to be the ones who provide the alcohol for the party. And they've got an opportunity to do that via their friend McLovin, who has obtained the single worst fake ID in the history of the world. Has one name on it, or one name on it, just McLovin from Hawaii. And a fantastic visual and a fantastic name. And really, Mintz Plasse is pretty great. That character is rightly remembered, I think.
That character's going to haunt him the rest of his career.
I don't know. Have you seen him now? He looks a lot different.
Really?
You wouldn't recognize him in a movie, I don't think, today.
Is that why he's not in movies? Because I'm just not recognizing him in them?
It's possible. This movie... I've seen Superbad so many times that I don't even laugh anymore when I'm watching it. I'm just kind of amused now. Because,
just sang it with him?
Yeah, basically I know it so well, so backwards and forwards, I don't even laugh anymore. I'm just kind of amused by it now. And that's just kind of, it's kind of film comfort food at this point. And I know some of it is kind of not aged well. That's, you know, and that's fine. You know, you have to take certain things, you know, as you go. But I adore this movie still. It's still one of my favorite go-to movies when I want to watch a movie. And I just enjoy everything. Michael Cera and Jonah Hill are just really, really funny together. And then you've got Emma Stone just showing what a movie star looks like at an early age. It's just... I love this movie.
I was watching Seth Rogen do an interview on YouTube today, an old one where he talked about this movie, and originally it was the funny guy and the straight guy, and when they brought Michael Cera in, and I'm just making it two funny guys, and this honestly reminds me kind of my friend, and me and my friend in high school, we didn't do anything, we just kind of hung out together, and then we went separate ways, and one thing that Booksmart caught well is like as soon as you graduate and move on, I mean, all of a sudden 15 years goes by and you might not talk to this person because they moved to Alabama or Africa in that movie. But I this is one of my favorite movies, and I can handle the stuff that I don't say anymore today,
right?
That I said back in the 90s, even though this wasn't set in the 90s necessarily. But just because I remember that time and it reminds me of, you know, who I was then, who my friends were, but I don't know. It just—it's such a funny movie. It's then you got Rogan and Bill Hader as cops that obviously would never in a million years happen.
No, but it's a great bit though in the movie, and they're really funny together.
Yeah, what do you think about this movie, Michael?
I just rewatched it, and there's the opening dialogue scene. Also reminiscent back to 80s movies, and Can't Buy Me Love. Me and my friends would play poker. And that opening dialogue, me and my friend Chris and my friend Nathan had that exact conversation in 1997 about an internet subscription service. It's not, kids don't know how it is, okay? It was difficult.
Porn wasn't always free.
The use of the camera at the end of the movie, that just like one's going up the escalator, one's going down, and it's just like this is real life. You're like, deuces, I'll see you in 10 years, or I'll be at the store, or we'll be at a ball game, or whatever, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and that both these movies capture that really well. You can definitely tell this is written by males and directed by males. but at the same time, I'm male, so I can relate to it. It's kind of perfect for me, even right. though I know Booksmart's probably a little more, or definitely a lot more progressive. But I still, this just... I could watch this every day of the week. There's not a weak spot in this movie. It's kind of like, you know, when I talk about Lord of the Rings or Almost Famous, where I just like being in the world. If they added 20 minutes to this movie that was totally unnecessary, I'd enjoy it because I just like what's going on the entire time.
And just enjoy these characters. I mean, these are just fun characters, fun, very relatable characters. And Jonah Hill and Michael Cera are so natural together. It's so unforced. They feel like best friends.
And even the scene where he's first with Emma Stone and they're in the cooking class, that is my friend. That is what he would stand be. I mean, he's literally, those things happen where he would stand behind him and like pretend like he's doing whatever to her, and then when she turns around, act like nothing was happening, even right. though she knew damn well what he was doing. And he had that charm where he could get away with shit like that. And not
Not to be too graphic, but it's like I had friends that were just identical to that. They were literally like terrier people, but they're humans. They would run and they would find like a piece of a tree or a piece of a couch, and they would just mount it, and they would think it's hilarious, and they would perform, and you're like, this is real life. People do this ridiculous over-the-top stuff.
Yeah, and this movie does have heart. I hate to keep saying that Booksmart has more heart than this, but this does have a heart. I mean, it's just what these guys are trying to do is get laid. What they're trying to do in Booksmart is, oh, we can have fun too.
But the scene, but there is a great scene, like when Jonah Hill picks up Michael Cera and carries him out of the party, mm-hmm. and is carrying him down the street. It's a lovely scene, and the you know their little drunk confession about the I love you too, man. It's really a sweet scene. It really is. It works.
They don't have these scenes for dudes ever in movies ever, unless it's like on the football field or on the battlefield. Like that's literally the only time, and it's very nice that this exists.
The scene at the end of Pineapple Express. Maybe Seth Rogen just has these scenes. But yeah, I love Superbad. I could watch it forever.
But that's the thing that Rogen does not get a lot of credit for is that emotional vulnerability that he brings to every role, really. I mean, he's willing to be that vulnerable in his movies. You see it in Long Shot, you see it in Knocked Up, and you see it in the characters that he created for this movie.
And clearly he was going to play this role, except for by the time they got it made, he was in his mid-20s. And he didn't look like a teenager like Jonah Hill did at the time, so I don't know. It's just phenomenal. All right, let's move on to 1989.
Since this is Aunt Bethany's 80th Christmas, I think she should lead us in the saying of grace.
What, dear? Grace! Grace! She passed away 30 years ago.
Let's start with Pink Cadillac and get that out of the way.
All right.
I did
best,
not...
best militia movie out there.
I remember my dad watching this as a kid and not watching it with him. I had no idea what this movie was about. I just kind of assumed it was about a car salesman until I watched it this week. What was I wrong?
Yeah, no, it's about what is this movie about? For fuck's sake, this movie's terrible. I mean, it is hard to watch. 2 hours of this movie is really, I mean, it feels like it ends like three times and it's never ending. Basically, Clint Eastwood is a bounty hunter. He goes out and picks up people who skip bail, and he ends up on the job trying to track down Bernadette Peters, who's been skipped bail and run off accidentally with the $1 million worth of money from a white power militia. And he's going to try and bring her back, but then I guess he falls in love with her. Did you realize this was a love story? I did not until they were literally kissing in the third act. I had no idea they were supposed to be falling in love in this movie because they have about the chemistry of like a human being in a wall. They have about the same chemistry as Bernadette Peters and Clint Eastwood. I thought it was like a father daughter situation at times, and then suddenly they're making out of nowhere, like just completely not set up because they have no chemistry. And
I blame him for that, though.
He's awful in this movie.
She's the best part of the movie,
yeah.
I think.
she's doing all of the work. He's just sort of there. And that's kind of Clint Eastwood's MO. He doesn't have a sense of humor, and he thinks he does. He thinks he can be funny, and he's not. This happens to him repeatedly throughout his career with Trouble with the Curve. It's like just an impossible to watch baseball movie because Clint Eastwood thinks he's funny, but he's not. He also loves working with his friends, his completely untalented friends, like the guy who directed this movie, who only directed three other movies, all of them with Clint, because he's actually Clint's buddy and his personal stuntman. So he gets his personal stuntman direct this idiot movie. Oh, man. I hate
it. Worked for Burt Reynolds. Didn't Burt Reynolds stuntman? Didn't he?
Probably.
Or no, stunt advisor. Yeah.
I hate this movie. It was so hard to watch. Clint Eastwood is not funny. He's just not, and he's not a romantic leading man either.
Well, it's kind of funny. I mean, he has the bad guy caught, literally could drive off with him and dump him, kill him, do whatever he wants, but he lets him go, and then he goes to go on a chase.
Yeah, what the fuck was that? Michael DeBars, by the way, who is just god-awful in everything.
I do like the side characters, though. Jimmy Skaggs, who I didn't know who that was until yesterday. He's the bad guy, or not the one of the drug deals at the beginning of Lethal Weapon that is trying to sell Mel Gibson cocaine or whatever. And then Bill Moseley, obviously, from several horror movies. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed them.
Yeah.
But this movie itself was just kind of... It was, like, worse than Roadhouse. And... Like it even
but not nearly as much fun.
Am I wrong, Michael?
You didn't like Roadhouse?
I know. No. Well, Roadhouse is fun, but this wasn't fun enough.
Yeah, there's not really any fun in this movie. It just seems like if you're a Clint Eastwood completist, you can watch it. And or if you're someone past 57 and you really enjoy it.
This is the reason why we got to get rid of the baby boomers. Well, let's get to the real movie, though.
Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade turns 30 this weekend, and as a 13-year-old, Sean watched this. He was enraptured by it. He just couldn't get enough. He loved every second of this movie from beginning to end. How, you know, it doesn't stop. How it's just the relentless action and the relentless buildup of Indiana Jones is the greatest character in the history of cinema. Adult Sean is going like, when is Steven Spielberg going to stop masturbating and get to making a movie? I hated this movie. I did. I hated it. I've grown up. Me is so grumpy now, apparently, because I was so mad from like the first moment to the last at this movie. So Indiana Jones and this Last Crusade basically is just them. It's Spielberg, George Lucas, and Harrison Ford just jerking off over themselves about how great their character is. So
I want to see that movie.
Probably be more entertaining. They're basically just here. We're going to cast the hottest teen actor to play the young Indiana Jones, and we're just going to cram all the fan service bullshit about how he got his hat, his jacket, his bullwhip, his scar, all that's going to be in like a 15-minute period of his life. And then we're going to jump ahead to him having James Bond as his dad, because of course James Bond is Indiana Jones' dad. Of course he is. Oh, screw you, you fucking... God.
Well, I mean, it just kind of feels like thematically, story-wise, it was perfect for what its time. Like, no matter how good Crystal Skull was, it was never going to be a good movie. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Indiana Jones has had its time. And if they decide to remake it eventually, then so be it, you know?
I was...
Sorry, we're in a flash flood warning and my phone's plugged into the... I'm on a hill, so I'm good, but... Sorry about that.
But I mean, I do love this movie. I've got this. I've got Back to the Future. I got Star Wars all on Laserdisc. Like, I cherish these movies. They're good. I mean, they're good for their time. I love them for what they are. I don't think they would hold up today. But for me, though, like, Temple of Doom is my favorite because you literally have a Goonies avatar to go on the adventure with you. And when you're like 7 or 8 years old and you want to think about what it was like being 7 or 8 years old, like I can go back and watch Temple of Doom again. And just thinking about like when I was in Cub Scouts, when I was like 7 or 8, all we did was talk about like just stupid gross out humor and like the chilled monkey brains and them eating the live snakes coming out of the mother. It was just like perfect for like a gross out booger humor 8 year old. But this movie, I loved it for the time. I like, can't wait for my kids to like it, but it feels like if they're past 10 years old, they're not going to like it.
I found it just relentlessly just irritating. The action, and granted, sometimes you like action when it's relentless and it doesn't slow down, but here it feels like they're just papering over the fact that they don't have much of a story and that this is only really there to service the fans the same way that they're servicing themselves. It's just relentless, over-the-top, just action scene, action scene, action scene. And they're not even that great an action scene. They're okay action scenes. And it just doesn't slow down for a moment. The only good thing is Connery. Connery, who I think, to me, in my mind, in my theory, is that this is Connery going, oh, you want me to be, like, dashing an adventurer, huh? No, I'm not gonna do that. I'm gonna wear tweed in the desert and be a professor and really not be any fun. And you guys are just going to have to live with that. You're not going to live off of my James Bondness. You're going to have to live with me playing the character as I want to play it. And that's my headcanon for this. That's the only way I can enjoy it, is that Connery's trying to subvert the whole movie.
I didn't watch a lot of Indiana Jones as a kid, so I, like, when we did Raiders of the Lost Ark, I was kind of shocked at how much people loved that movie. I thought it was either, it couldn't decide if it wanted to be Out of Africa or, you know, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. It was like, it wasn't quite good enough to be a great movie, but it wasn't quite fun enough to be a fun movie, so I did, and I also watched it on DVD on a 4K TV, so it looked really shitty on top of that. I don't remember Temple of Doom. I haven't seen that in forever. So I kind of watched this with fresh eyes, knowing full well that Sean wasn't liking it because he was texting me things like, is Eskimo Brothers a relevant term that enough people know?
We're not only father and son, but we're also brothers.
Which I didn't remember that from this movie until I watched it. I'm like, that's why he asked me about Eskimo Brothers.
It's in my review. Yeah, I mentioned Eskimo Brothers because father and son both sleep with the same character in this movie, which problematic at the very least. She's also just a plot point who is there to be, gawked at and ogled and slept with by both the main stars and tossed away, which is, you know, there's a lovely way to portray a character.
She was a Nazi.
She talks in her sleep.
Right. But at the same time, I will say, I've got mad at, like, The Force Awakens for being nothing but a fan service movie, in my opinion. But pretending like it's not. This one knows it's a fan service movie that's servicing the fans. So I don't care. I mean, I like Rocky IV. There's no story there. It's just a ton of fun. And so I can see the fun in this, and I enjoy it. Unfortunately, my kid did not want to watch it with me, which he wanted to watch Fighting With My Family for like the third time. But I enjoyed it for what it was. Mm-hmm. I thought I was going to hate it way more based on what Sean was telling me. But as I'm watching, I was like, I can see the fun in this. And mm-hmm. Great. I think Michael's right. It goes back to the fact that I remember Goonies and all those movies, and it is that kind of silly fun, and nostalgia plays a huge role in me enjoying it. But I had fun with it.
My nostalgia goggles aren't working anymore, apparently, because, you know, this happened to me. Sorry to say this, Michael. This happened to me watching Superman 78 recently, where I was like, okay, ugh. Yeah. And now this, and like, I'm just groaning my way through these movies that I know I enjoyed as a child.
I think it's fantastic. I think it's good. I hope my kids will like it, but I don't. I think it may have passed them. Like, do you think your son actually liked it, Bob?
I think he would to an extent. I don't think it would be one though that he latches on to, but I think he would be able to. I mean, he talks about Indiana Jones, having seen none of them. He references him enough. He also does it with the Star Wars characters before he saw any of those. Hmm. So he knows, you know, what it is, but apparently he wanted to. Well, and my son, my daughter had a friend over, and I think my son kind of thought she was cute, so they watched Fighting With My Family together instead. But I think he would like it. But I don't know. Josh, I remember him saying his son wasn't a big Raiders of the Lost Ark fan. Hmm. He referred to that one as the boring one. Which, yeah, I'm kind of with him.
Josh related that story through tears, by the way.
Poor bastard's not here to defend
himself. As far as one that's going to stand the test of time, I think it's definitely the first one. Like, that one will last. Because, I mean, it's like this throwback to everything from the 30s and all those serials and everything like that. But yeah. There's just that, I mean, there's that part of that nerd culture that, like, Back to the Future, Star Wars, Indiana Jones, like, early 90s culture. It was like, it grabbed on to me and my friends. Like, I don't know what you were doing on December 31st, 1999. Me and my friends were like, let's go, man. It's going to be the end of the world. Let's go to Times Square. So, like, we went to Times Square, and we parked in New Jersey, and we drove on the, like, and we rode the train over. And me and my friend kept doing, like, the visual quote from The Last Crusade, where, like, it looks like he's got, like, almost the Middle Eastern guy, part of the cult, the Christian cult or whatever. It almost looks like he's got, like, spider legs or something, like, from giant fuzzy spiders. And you're like, my soul's prepared. It's yours. And we kept, like, showing each other our necks, like, my soul, like, anything could happen. Y2K, man, let's go see what happens. And it was just like that. That would also, I mean, that also kind of got my nostalgia goggles on this movie too, because I'm going to think about going on that trip for the rest of my life, just like right. My soul's prepared is yours.
I will say that you chose poorly. Read through my mind a lot.
Yeah.
Far more than you chose. You chose wisely.
That's funny. I had to stay home on 1999, December 31st. My parents were afraid of the end of the world. I wanted to go to a Metallica concert in Detroit, and they're like, no, you're not going to Detroit on December 31st, 1999.
All the planes were going to fall out of the sky. You'd be trapped there.
Right. Ted Nugent was opening. It would have been great.
Just a heads up, there's a really great podcast about Y2K if you want to check that out.
I don't. It's okay. What's it called?
It's from the same guy who did Finding Richard Simmons.
Oh, okay.
If that helps. I can't remember the name of it.
I used to listen to the wrestling podcast. And a couple Cubs podcasts. anything else on 1989 before we move on?
Those were the only two, I believe.
Yes. All right.
Michael, did you want to reflect on anything?
No, that's it for now.
All right. Next week, we got Godzilla 2, Ma, Rocket Man. Our classic is going to be Tommy. The album turns 40.
Nice.
Along with the being a nice Elton John thing. 1989, My Mom's a Werewolf, Renegades, Vampire's Kiss, No Holds Barred. I've never seen that.
How have you never seen that?
Because I'm an In-N-Out Wrestling fan. And then Dead Poet Society, so it should be another fun 89.
Michael, can you give Bob a sense of what he's in for with No Holds Barred?
You've never seen No Holds Barred?
No.
It's everything Golden Globus and Canon Films could ever produce. I don't know if they did that one or not, but I'm sure it was a lot of cocaine was involved in
that movie. This one quote that's going to live in your mind forever, Bob. Dookie!
I have listened to podcasts about the movie. So I do know Hulk Hogan and Vince McMahon wrote together.
Yeah.
Is there anything else before we... did you want to stick around for Flick Chart, Michael, or do you have to get going?
I think you might be...
my daughter's here. I think I should get going. Thanks, right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for coming on the podcast. Hopefully we see you soon.
Thank you, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. That is our show. Before I let you go, I want to thank our Patreon supporters. We'll start with Charlie Messing and the Hall of Famer podcaster Jason Bryant at our key grip level. Our character actors Josh and Beth Paul, Cousin Jeff, and Christina Cato.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Our special effects level Corey Finneran from IVNV and Sarah Morell.
May the force be with you.
Our associate producer, Jason Mollett.
Everybody has to eat shaving cream once in a while.
And our movie stars, Uncle Jeff and Dave Seavers.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
If you want to be a Patreon supporter, head over to ihatecritics.net/Patreon to help support the podcast. Get yourself a credit on the show. I'll start looking at merch here soon. We need to get some stuff out again. And that bonus podcast with Josh, where we go through every movie from our entire life. Not every movie. Every year of our entire life.
The best movie of each year of your life.
That is up on Patreon. If you haven't, if you need a copy of the link and you're a Patreon supporter, let me know and I'll get it to you. Also, PayPal. If you pay through PayPal, you can get access to that as well. You just have to let me know on Facebook. Otherwise, let's jump to Flick Chart and finish off the show. Nebraska, 2013, or Hitch?
Nebraska.
I agree. Aladdin's kind of like Hitch in a lot of ways. Did you notice that at all?
It is. When you get down to it. Oh, wow. That is like a glass-breaking revelation. It really is a lot like that. Wow.
Halfway through the movie, it hit me.
I completely missed it, but you're right.
Sweet Home Alabama or Swingers?
Oh, Swingers. Good God, I hate Sweet Home Alabama. That's like one of the all-time worst movie-going experiences of my life. And I love Reese Witherspoon. That movie sucks.
But I also love swingers, so it's easy for me. Yeah. Speed or rock and rolla?
Speed.
Agreed. The Town or Goodfellas?
It's Goodfellas, but The Town is an incredible movie.
I'm with you.
I mean, Goodfellas honestly may just be nostalgia. Like,
we'll find out in a year.
Yeah.
Although there's some pretty iconic scenes in that movie.
But I've had such a struggle with Scorsese lately. I wonder what's going on there.
We may be flipping a coin here. The Exorcist or Eraser?
Which one's Eraser?
Arnold Schwarzenegger, 1996. Right.
That's not that bad, actually.
Man, I'm losing the coin flips right and left.
I really don't care for The Exorcist, so yeah, I'll go with Eraser.
All right, let's see what George says. Thank God. The Exorcist it is. Babe or Jingle All the Way?
Babe.
Josh will be happy. Come on, Internet.
That wasn't much of a competition.
I know. But neither was The Exorcist or The Eraser. Is it true that I was listening to a podcast where they were claiming there were subliminal messages in The Exorcist which made people like it better than it was?
I believe that.
Of course you do. Maverick or The Green Berets?
I've never actually seen The Green Berets.
All right. Maverick or... League, or I'm sorry, apparently it's not going to let me choose. Bad Boys 2 or The Lead of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Ooh, God, that is a brutal choice. I'll go Bad Boys 2 because I guess it made me laugh once, and I hated League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, so.
I don't remember how many times it made me laugh, but it made me laugh enough. But I'll go Bad Boys as well. Maverick or Munich?
Munich.
Yeah, it was funnier than Maverick. I'll go Munich, too. Searching for Bobby Fischer or The Danish Girl?
I like The Danish... Yeah, it's The Danish Girl.
Agree. Decisions. I love how this gives me something to say whenever I'm waiting for it to load. Something positive on the screen. Run, Lola, Run or Sweeney Todd, the musical, 1982?
No.
You seen that one?
I've only seen the Johnny Depp Sweeney Todd.
Apparently, I'm no longer allowed to just pick one movie. Huh. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, or Braveheart?
Robin Hood for me. I hate Braveheart.
Braveheart for me, and I just nailed my computer, and wow, two for two. Braveheart beats Prince of Thieves. Wolf of Wall Street or Run, Lola, Run?
It's Run, Lola, Run.
I agree. And not because Scorsese sucks, that movie just pisses me off. A little too effective. Just one more rank. Me reading the Blazing Saddles or Hail Caesar.
Ooh, that's a good one, man. I love both those movies. I'll go Blazing Saddles because I've seen it more.
Man, I want to go Hail Caesar, even though I know Blazing Saddles is supposed to be the answer. I'll flip it. Blazing Saddles, it is. Tangled or Signs?
No, they're a good lineup there. I like Tangled a lot, but Signs is Signs. I really like. I still have a strong connection to, despite Mel Gibson.
I'm with you. Now it says I've got a bad feeling about this. They must not have liked that we picked Signs over Tangled. Ooh, Judge Dredd or Evil Dead? 81.
Well, that's no contest. It's Evil Dead.
I do like Stallone, but The Wolf of Wall Street or The Jerk?
The Jerk.
Bernadette Peters again.
Far better Bernadette Peters movie. He hates these cans. Stay away from the cans. I kiss them through my head at least once a day.
Really?
I don't know why.
I used to hate The Jerk, but a little time away helped it out. Come on. Underworld Evolution, The Hot Scots.
Never heard of that one.
Three Stooges movie. Challenge accepted. My internet is not doing well today. I'm amazed that Michael sounded so good. Batman 89, X-Men 2.
Batman 89.
I agree. that's coming up in the next couple of weeks as well.
Yeah, I think I don't have to worry too much about the nostalgia of that one. I've seen it enough since then to know that it still holds up.
Yeah, and it's the quotability too helps. It's one of those movies where I can just sit and say every line with the actors. That's like 2-3 weeks. It's pretty soon.
You know, it's interesting when we're talking about Last Crusade and comparing it now with that, is that it is the ones that you go back to that are the ones that do obviously hold up. I think that's probably an obvious statement now that I'm saying it, but really, truly, though, I mean, it just shows what a great movie is when you go back and watch it so many times, and that's what Batman 89 is, whereas I didn't go back and watch Last Crusade a lot, maybe a couple times, revisit it here and there, but not much since I was 13.
The Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Death Proof?
The original
Hold
Texas.
Hold on. 2003.
It's Death Proof. I would have chosen the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre over Death Proof. As much as I love Death Proof.
As good as it gets, American History X.
That's tough. I'll go As Good As It Gets.
I will as well.
Although I'm afraid to watch that movie again.
I want to watch that movie again to find out if I like it as much as I did the first time.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking that way too. It's been almost 20 years.
I mean, American History X was ruined for me when we watched that. I mean, it has its effective moments, but overall.
Yeah.
All right, this is our last one. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles or Fun with Dick and Jane?
Fun with Dick and Jane.